broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Almonds and vines and lawns drink up the last of shallow short-term water, then suck on the black depths with a draw mightier than the moon's, and suck. In sudden places the ground puckers and caves. Far westward China smokes. Nobody sees the rains fail until they have. Tableland and mesas crack. In the mountains, the snowpack thins. Meltwater, now brown, reluctant drops. Cities gasp in the sun's stare. Faucets cough. And families turn inwards. There must be somebody to blame. Better ourselves than no one. We brag of damage done, but whether we could truly dry all rain, bake all earth, science does not know. The wastefulness was all ours, but this fetid heat could be a planetary impersonal adjustment, like an ice age. So it might well be wise to keep always face paint and ash about us. When the last clouds wagon train off, loincloth and invocation will be the one hope for last woman and last man discovering she's pregnant. California Dreaming, Lachlan McKinnon. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Let me ask you, do you really think it possible that we could kill the Earth? That our carbon-based society will truly dry all rain, bake all earth, as the poet McKinnon says? If not, then why does the great mathematician Stephen Hawking tell us that in order to survive, our species must colonize other planets within the next 100 years? To explore Hawking's question, we're talking about climate change today, and my guest is Dr. Michael Allen. Dr. Allen is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Geography at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. His research explores the intersection of weather and climate on human health as it relates to extreme temperatures, climate variability, and change. His publications in scholarly journals include articles in Physical Geography, Theoretical and Applied Climatology, and the International Journal of Climatology. Dr. Allen's research on seasonal climate change has also been highlighted by National Geographic. Michael, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you so much. It's really happy to be here today.
Michael, tell us a little bit about yourself and particularly this relationship to the National Geographic, which I'm sure all our listeners are familiar with and very well known to us. What is your relationship to National Geographic?
So a little bit of background about myself. I actually started as a pre-med major and actually getting frustrated with chemistry and not really understanding it. I kind of reflected on life and went back to a small state school south of Pittsburgh, California, University of Pennsylvania, where I majored in earth science meteorology. And then I was really interested in just weather forecasting, climate I then kind of stumbled upon the discipline of geography and really started to explore the so what's, and was sick of the math of atmospheric science, didn't see the utility, and that's just me as a person, not necessarily that there's not value to that by any means. But I really wanted to take my interest in health and my interest in climate and weather and see the application. And so I started to do research on the relationship between health and society and climate and weather. And so worked towards master's, PhD at Kent State University. And while traveling at a conference several years ago, I got a phone call from National Geographic, a writer for their magazine or their news week stories, and she had stumbled upon my recent publication on seasonal climate change and just wanted to write about that as it intersected with some other recent research out of Europe and China with respect to seasonal climate change. And so despite all of my peer review, all of the grants I've been affiliated with and worked on, my personal career has really defined my personal ambition has been fulfilled in terms of the yellow box has kind of grabbed my research and highlighted it. And I think that kind of just speaks to my interest in kind of science communication and the utility of seasons, the utility of climate on everyday life. So that's kind of the brief introduction, Reader's Digest version of who I am and how Nat Geo kind of stumbled upon some of that research.
That's interesting. Michael, how'd you get here to Old Dominion University?
Sure. So in the 2014, I was on the job market finishing my PhD, applied to a variety of places, and Old Dominion University, the Department of Political Science and Geography here, had a position open for environmental geography. I applied, and the rest is history. So I've really been fortunate here at ODU to work with a variety of scholars, from professionals in the Health Science College to people in the College of Sciences. We're working with oceanographers, nonprofits, and a variety of stakeholders to really draw attention to these issues with respect to climate change, and in the classroom as well as out into the general public.
Michael, with our recent hurricanes that are coming in abundance now, and the poor Midwest of the United States ravaged by tornadoes these days. And I live on Kent Island in Maryland, and we even had a tornado come across our small island and do some damage, and the earthquakes in Mexico. Is this generating more attention to your field of study than normal at this time of our history?
I teach a hazards course, and so the earthquakes in Mexico, the hurricanes in the southeast U.S., a variety of other kind of natural and technological hazards in our recent memory are kind of fun to teach in that regard. I think there's somewhat of a disconnect in terms of what those events signify. Earthquakes throw that out in terms of geophysical process, but in terms of the relationship between hurricanes and tornadoes and blizzards and the like with climate, I think there's some missing ingredients to that discussion with context of weather versus climate and understanding those differences between what is weather, tornadoes, hurricanes, and how that plays into the discussion around climate and climate change.
Well, even though he is not a climatologist, Stephen Hawking is an imposing figure in the world of science. Should we be frightened by his comment that we have about 100 years to find some place to live other than this planet?
So one thing that got me interested in science was this idea of observation, of exploration, of innovation. And so while I understand and recognize what Stephen Hawking is saying, and he is a renowned scholar in his field, and Elon Musk is doing similar things in terms of exploring the world and the solar system and the like, I think that's what gets a lot of people interested in science, is pushing the envelope and kind of forward projecting these ideas. With that said, I'm a little bit apprehensive to jump on the bandwagon of 100 years or less, and then what are we going to do? I'm actually more inspired by the opportunity than frustrated or see it as a doomsday scenario. There's a variety of journalistic examples I often use in my hazards classes and others that talk about how climate change is doomsday or even apocalyptic. And while they're good for journalism, I'm not sure they advance the discussion in terms of climate change and other issues. That's not to downplay the danger. I think it's important to communicate the threat with regard to climate change, but it's also recognizing that the problem is solvable. And there's a lot of research from the social sciences that suggests that if we communicate climate change or a variety of other issues as doomsday, people often get frustrated and kind of move back from the discussion as opposed to being moving forward and solving and addressing the problems as well as the opportunities in that.
Well, let's explore this a little bit then. And like any good scientist, let's define our terms a bit here and the problem. What is global warming? And when you measure as a scientist global warming, what is the baseline that you're working from? You it seems to me you've got to have a starting point, and then things are better or worse based on that starting point. What's global warming, and what's the baseline you use to measure the heating index?
Sure. So global warming, I'll probably refer to it as climate change just because of difference in nomenclature. When we talk about global warming, I use this to define it in my class. It's like putting a turkey in the oven, right? And so globally, the turkey is going to heat up. But the outside crust might heat up differently than the interior and the breast and the thigh, what have you. And so the turkey on average is heating, but there's variability in terms of how regionally those changes are manifest. And so if we put a thermometer in the earth, on average, across the landscape, ocean and land, we see a warming trend. Now, what's the baseline? I think that's an interesting way to propose that question. The baseline is really based on paleoclimate records, that ice cores that have millennia of data in them in the Antarctic and the Arctic, and tree ring, dendrochronology records, land sediment records, and a variety of these paleoclimate records really give us an understanding of what the past climate has been like. And we recognize that it has been warmer. We recognize that there has been more CO2 in the atmosphere than there is in present day 2017 planet Earth. But we weren't here then. And so thinking about what has changed, particularly since roughly the mid-19th century, the Industrial Revolution, is that temperature and CO2 emissions have worked in parallel. And what does that mean for the future with respect to our globe?
So it seems to me, Michael, that in terms of climate change and in the little bit of research I did in anticipation of our conversation, it seemed to me that one of the primary issues is in fact the warming, one of the aspects of climate change, I guess. One might say, is the warming of the planet and the warming of our weather, the air we live in. How narrow a range do we have as human beings and maybe even as life on the planet? What is our range and what is happening with climate change within that range?
So the range is a good question. I think humans will adapt. We will adapt to change. That's kind of how we've evolved as a species. That's how society and other species have evolved as a whole, that species adapt. The concern comes into At what rate are we seeing these changes? And the rate in which we're seeing these changes with respect to global temperature and other aspects, the rate is of concern in that there's been life before us and there will be life after us in terms of ecology and planet Earth. And microbes exist in Yellowstone's geysers that are very, very hot, and they exist in the Arctic where it's very, very cold. And so in terms of how we think about life, we can adapt, but at what rate can we adapt? And we say, well, it's only a degree of change in terms of temperature. And yes, it's a 1 or 2 degree, maybe 3 or 4 degree change in temperature. And I can put my coat on. But if my internal body temperature changes 1 or 2 degrees, I'm going to the hospital because that's called a fever. And if your temperature gets to be 102 degrees, you might die. And similarly, small scale, the dung beetle, for instance, if you change the temperature of that environment for the dung beetle to live in, that organism might not be able to adapt as quickly as it needs to survive. And we see this, you know, the Center for Biological Diversity cites that baseline, we have 1 or 2 or 3, maybe 5 extinctions per year. And now we're looking at dozens a day, hundreds per year. And what does this mean in terms of how we fit into this puzzle piece called planet Earth? And so really the concern is what is the rate of change and what does that mean for our future in terms of a species and as a planet?
I think it's interesting that I started out our discussion by saying that is it possible that we could kill the planet? And what I think I heard you just say is that it's probably impossible for the planet, all life on the planet, to die because there are microbes, there are things that live in very extreme temperatures, and they're quite happy. In fact, they can't live without those temperatures. So we can find, and there have been die-offs in the past and so forth. So we have to really focus. Well, let me make it as a question. Should we really focus in terms of climate change on human beings and the capacity of human beings to survive the kind of changes that we could be looking at? And this then goes back to Hawking's comment as well.
Yeah, so the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, really highlight this One Health framework in that human health is related to human health, right? If I cough or sneeze in this room right now, those microbes might work their way into your nostrils, and then you might get the flu, for instance. And I'm not going to do either of those, but you get the point.
Thank you. we appreciate that.
And similarly, our health is also related to animal health. We eat animals. Some of us eat animals. Some of us interact with animals, whether that be hunting, whether that be, you know, out in the landscape as a fisherman getting, you know, in the environment. Pets are animals, and so we interact with these species. So those diseases can transmit from animal to human. And similarly, our health is also related to plants, right? Poison ivy, you'll have poison ivy. And those things interact with one another, plants, animals, and humans. Thinking about that in terms of this One Health paradigm really highlights our relationship to the ecosystem. We're not independent of the ecosystem. And so when we're thinking about addressing or combating, fighting the war on climate change, perhaps, we have to recognize that, yeah, climate change has happened in the past and it's going to happen in the future, yes. The last glaciation period, the Wisconsin glaciation period, roughly 20,000 years ago, plus or minus a decade, we had ice that covered New York City. We had ice that carved out the Great Lakes. And over the course of the retreat of those glaciers, about 10,000 years, we had about a 4 degree centigrade change. But in the last 100, 150 years, we've observed about a degree change. So the rate is significantly different. And with respect to the ecosystems, the world, the ecosystems will adapt, yes. But at what cost and what will we be missing in terms of this One Health relationship with nature is something worth to think about.
Is one of the concerns, however, though, that the rate is increasing, and the rate is increasing because of human activity, particularly the carbon-based world that we live in now.
Yeah, the rate is definitely greater than we've seen using paleoclimate records. And what does that look like for the future? Using what we understand the climate system, we should actually be cooling, and yet we're not. And so if we're warming without the natural phenomenons that we have an understanding of how the climate operates, you know, solar radiance, a variety of other natural causes of climate change, we know the causes of the observed temperature changes, and maybe our addiction to oil, and we can talk about this later on, has inhibited some of our action to address climate intervention.
Yeah, I want to stay for a moment, if we can, with the results of climate change and the impact. I tend to be a little bit more of a doomsday, a little bit more pessimistic about the effects than you do. But then I'm not a climate change scientist either, like Stephen Hawking is not as well. But then later on, I would like to talk about our denial of climate change and then what we can do about it. But again, the effects of climate change. It seems to me that I read something about a 6-degree increase, and you mentioned 4 degrees, I think, earlier. Is there some discussion among the scientists between whether the impact of 4 degrees increase or 6 degree? The 6-degree increase from the one author that I read seemed to be a pretty dramatic increase.
Yeah, so we're all familiar with the recent hurricanes, and so if you're watching the Weather Channel or your local forecaster, they probably showed a variety of what we call spaghetti plots as to where the hurricane track might go, right? And so we do the same thing with climate models. And with climate models, we're not interested in giving you a forecast for January 27th, 2084, right? That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in large-scale phenomenon. We're looking at large-scale pressure patterns and how those semi-permanent pressure patterns change over the long term. And so, and what does that mean in terms of impact? And so when we're thinking about climate projections, they do the same thing as they do with hurricane models, for instance. We took a range of scenarios, and they're labeled A, B, C, and the like in terms of how we define these. And there's a low emission scenario, there's a mid emission scenario, and I'm not going to get all science-y on you right now. But
Well, thank you, Gary. thank you. We don't have charts in front of us yet, Michael.
Sure, but so you imagine the low emission scenario is we stop all greenhouse gas emissions right now. And it's a low emission scenario because that's not likely, because tonight when I go home, I'm going to have to drive. Fine. And we also have a high emission scenario. And these climate models take into account demographics changes. They take into account socioeconomic characteristics. It takes into account policy. It takes into account, you know, what will the world look like today, tomorrow, and into the future with respect to these decisions that we're going to make.
Michael, let me ask you a remedial question here for me. What are greenhouse gases and how are they generated and what happens to them when they are generated and as a result, climate change is impacted by these greenhouse gases?
So greenhouse gases, if we wouldn't have a greenhouse, we wouldn't have planet Earth as we know it, because we wouldn't live here. And so greenhouse gases, some of the discussions, let's stop the greenhouse effect. And it's like, no, don't stop the greenhouse effect. We'll be a ball of ice. So that's not the reasonable discussion. And so what we're really talking about is the enhancement of this natural phenomenon, right? Trees have carbon in them, and they absorb CO2, carbon dioxide. During the summer season, when we have leaves on the trees, those CO2 sinks, they capture and they store that CO2. But come autumn, right, so the leaves are beginning to change right now, those leaves fall off. And consequently, the CO2 that is in the atmosphere and the CO2 that is in those leaves and plants, living material, and the CO2 that comes from other non-natural sources, anthropogenic, human-caused sources, you know, stuff coming out of your tailpipe, industrial pollutants coming from sites and cities and the like, they fill the atmosphere. And there's a really nice NASA year map video of the CO2 cycle. And it's really fascinating for my students to see that and recognizing that air from China eventually works its way here. And so that we're connected again in this large ecosystem. And so greenhouse gases are not just CO2. There's methane. But the CO2 is really in those others. But CO2, carbon dioxide, is really the major culprit because of the residence time, in that CO2 stays in the atmosphere much longer than these other greenhouse gases. And it's physics and chemistry, and fine, I'm not going to get into those details again. But so the CO2 that's in the atmosphere now really is going to be there for a while. And so the concern with respect to your earlier question with regard to the temperature change is we've kind of committed to 400 and some odd parts per million today. And what does this look like in 2050 or 2100 with respect to CO2, if that CO2, some of that's going to remain in the atmosphere for the next 100 or 200 years? And so in terms of those projections of temperature, sea level rise, and others, those questions remain with respect to future scenarios.
So what does the CO2 in the air do relative to the heating, though? I mean, I keep hearing the talk about heat is trapped. Is it trapped underneath this layer of CO2? Is that what's going on? And what generates the heat?
Sure, that's a great question. So we live in the troposphere. It's the lowest layer of the atmosphere. And above us, we have the stratosphere and the ionosphere and the like. And each of these layers have certain characteristics. And we live in the troposphere, we fly in the troposphere, weather occurs in the troposphere. Okay.
What the troposphere is, what is what level then?
It's the lowest layer, we'll call it 10 miles, roughly. I'm not going to be that precise, but we'll go with that. 10 miles in height. It's where we live. And so all the CO2 that is in our lower atmosphere, the troposphere, acts to absorb radiation. And so sun comes and hits your car and bounces back off, or some sun hits particles of CO2 and it warms, just in terms of thermodynamics, it warms the lower atmosphere. And so when the discussion of global warming, do we know it's anthropogenic or natural, is we know that it's anthropogenic in that the stratosphere, which is the layer above us, this is where the ozone hole is and the like. And the stratosphere, if it was natural, would be warming at the same rate or near the same rate as we see in the troposphere, and that's not the case. And so we know, because of these greenhouse gases, CO2 and the like, that the warming of our planet is attributed in much regard, not entirely, but much regard to these anthropogenic sources of CO2. Other greenhouse gases, there's ozone. Ozone is O3, and so that's a photochemical reaction. CO2 is one part carbon, two parts oxygen, right? So it's CO2. And when sun hits, reacts, it can break up particles and the like. And so you have these chemical reaction, photochemical reactions, and so you have things like ground-level ozone. And so when we think about ozone hole is in the stratosphere, so ozone's good, right? Because if we have ozone, it blocks incoming solar radiation, reducing cancer and the like. And this is particularly of interest in places like Australia. But when we think about ozone in the troposphere, where we live, ozone is not good. because we don't want to breathe. We don't live in the stratosphere. We don't want to breathe ozone. And so ozone and a variety of other particulate matter really messes with our bronchial tubes, respiratory issues, and the like. And that's really kind of where my interests are with in terms of public health outcomes and climate change and how these kind of ricochet on top of each other with respect to the greenhouse effect, temperature, but also air quality and the like.
And how does that affect the warming of the ocean, for instance? It seems we've talked primarily about the greenhouse effect of the air that that we're in, but we're particularly concerned about the ocean. How does climate change impact the warmth of the ocean?
Sure. So similarly to observed changes in terms of land temperature, we see similar relationships with respect to the oceans. The oceans are warming. 2014 was the warmest year on record until 2015, and then 2015 was then surpassed by 2016. And so many of our warmest years globally on average have occurred in the last 16 or 17 years, this millennium. And so with respect to the ocean, some of the questions might be better answered by an oceanographer, but the ocean acts as a CO2 sink in some regard. And similarly, you have relationships to CO2 increases and pH changes. And so if you change the composition of the atmosphere, similarly, you're changing the composition of the ocean. And by changing the composition of the ocean, you then have ricocheting impacts in terms of coral reef development, for instance, off the coast of, again, Australia. Or you have issues with respect to food security in places that use or harvest oysters, for instance. If you change the pH, if you change the chemical composition of the estuary of the Chesapeake Bay, for instance, that can have implications not only to food security, but economics. Places like Tangier Island are really reliant upon fishing and that industry. And so we inadvertently are, or advertently perhaps, intentionally, modifying people's lives by the decisions that we are making collectively. I'm not saying we as in you or I, but collectively as planet Earth, collectively making these decisions. And so you have similar relationships in terms of the ocean effects, in terms of temperature, similar effects in terms of acidity, and those ricochet downstream to other issues that we can talk about.
Well, the major issue that the warming of the seas that we hear a lot about now, particularly, is flooding, and I have to wrap my mind around how a warming ocean gets bigger, how it swells up, because that's what the flooding is, isn't it? It's not necessarily wind blowing the water up on the land. It's that the ocean is encroaching. It's getting bigger and overrunning its normal bank. Am I accurate at all in that description?
Yeah, sure. There's some validity to that statement. So if you have an ice cube on this table, by the course of the end of this interview, it will melt, right? And so water, when it heats up, expands, or H2O expands. And so with a warming land, warming sea, naturally your ocean, as you said, swells perhaps. Okay. But consequently also you have melting glaciers. Greenland and the Antarctic are melting. And the changes in the Arctic are of interest. Not little glaciers on land, because if a glacier's on land, it's not displacing water. If you have ice that's sitting in the water, it's already displacing that water. But if you have ice on land, Greenland, Antarctic, it's not displacing water. And so if you have a melting continent of ice, Greenland, Antarctica, Greenland's not a continent, but you get the point, that water is now going to go into the ocean and force it to rise. And okay, getting away from the doomsday scenario there, but we see real changes in the Arctic. Some great videos, again, online. We have so much information, we're often overwhelmed, but I like going to NASA. NASA, we went to the moon with them. So I go to NASA for my information with respect to these issues, and NASA has visualizations of the changing Arctic, melting sea ice, and the ice that reforms there in the winter is not reforming in the same way as it did in the 1970s, for instance. And the melting Arctic and the changing ocean currents and the like, really the national security. Department of Defense have highlighted climate change as a national security threat. And so, again, I'm now drawing into other issues with respect to national security and military preparedness. If you open up the Arctic, as it seems like it may do in the not-too-distant future, you have passageways for some international nation states to pass through, and what does that do in terms of geopolitics? So these are questions. These are questions that we're seeing. We often think about climate change as something in the future, right? What's the sea going to look like in 2100? And that's a fruitful discussion to have in terms of planning and being prepared. But really, we're seeing the evidence of climate change today. We see warming Earth. Yes, we see coastal flooding in Norfolk, where I live. We've had a 10- to 12-fold increase in flooding hours downtown at the Hague. If you're familiar, the Chrysler Museum there. In Norfolk, we've had 15 inches of sea level rise since the 1920s, twice the global rate. Yes, some of that's tied to land subsidence. I always chuckle when people say, you've had 15 inches of rain, or 15 inches of sea level rise, but you know some of that's accounted for in land subsidence. And I say, yes, I do know this. I am informed in terms of how these processes work. But it still remains that we've had 15 inches. And so a hurricane that impacted Hampton Roads in 1920 is very different than it would be in 2017. 15 inches of water higher. There are serious implications for that today, not in the future only. We have ongoing wildfires in California, and I'm not saying that climate change is causing wildfires or climate change is causing Hurricane Harvey, but climate change is Dr. Marshall Shepp at the University of Georgia has some good TED Talks, and he highlights that weather is your mood and climate is your personality, and that climate change actually enhances the probability. Do you play cards at all? No? Okay. I do occasionally. I also watch baseball. He has another analogy with respect to baseball.
Mrs. Wilson plays all the cards in our family. When I want to do something, I have a few cards I have to play, but those are different kind of cards, Michael.
So, but when you're playing cards, right, you're familiar probably with an ace, right? The ace is perceived as a good card or a bad card, depending on how you're looking at it. But in a card deck of 52, climate change is adding another ace to the deck or adding another two or three aces to the deck. And so when you flip over a card, a Hurricane Harvey or a wildfire, for instance, that card is maybe not caused by climate change. But the probability of you drawing that ace, if you have six aces in the deck now instead of four, is increased. Or he uses maybe a better analogy for your audience, is baseball, right? Naturally, baseball players hit home runs. But in the steroid era, by taking steroids, that probability of an individual hitting a home run is enhanced, all things equal, right? And so when we think about climate change with its relationship to weather, is that the discussion is not, is Hurricane Matthew, for instance, was that caused by climate change or global warming? The answer is no. I don't look at causation. I look at relationships. I will say that Hurricane Matthew, Hurricane Harvey, the probability of those events are becoming more frequent and more likely with respect to climate change and taking into account climate change.
One activity that is very much in the news today are the wildfires that are occurring in California. What is, if any, is the relationship between just the unusual number of fires, particularly in the dry West, that we're seeing? What is there a connection to climate change that we should be concerned about there?
So again, I think it's the causation aspect here again, but so the wildfires in California climate change is a piece of a Jenga block. And so climate change is one piece of this puzzle. If you have prolonged drought, for instance, and you're seeing this in parts of East Africa right now, prolonged drought, that is one aspect of these issues. But we also have to talk about like land use policy or management of our landscape. Nobody likes a wildfire, right? But wildfires are actually natural. They burn out the underbrush, they clear out, and they create new environments for new species to grow and thrive. And so actually by stopping wildfires, which is good in terms of my home is there, we've actually enhanced the probability of those wildfires becoming more catastrophic. And we saw this last year or 2 years ago, I guess, in Tennessee, where several people were killed outside the Smoky Mountains. And some of that was attributed to prolonged drought in the Southeast, policies associated with reducing wildfire burning. In California, they have a variety of other. Well, I won't say anything about that. But there's a multitude of causes, and climate change is one aspect of what potentially led to a catastrophic event in California.
You mentioned earlier the impact of climate change on food. Food production. Would you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so California has been under a significant drought. Recent rainfall and snowfall has helped. But there's evidence. GRACE satellite, for instance, measures the gravitational pull of water underground. We don't see water underground because it's underground, but we use a lot of water that is underground. And so when we think about where we grow our food, we grow a lot of food over these aquifers. There's a large aquifer in the Midwest stretching from South Dakota down through West Texas. And we pump water from underground and water all types of crops. And these aquifers exist in the range of the Himalayas and elsewhere around the world. And what we're seeing is by using that water, we can grow our food. We can grow lettuce in a desert through these processes. And that's all well and good. The question becomes is what happens if we don't recharge that reservoir of water? And a lot of the rain that we're experiencing, they call it rain bombs, in that you get a lot of rain over a short period of time. And consequently, when you get a lot of rain over a short period of time, the water can't percolate down through the soil, and consequently, it's not going to refill the aquifer. And so despite having significant rain in parts of California, there's some evidence to suggest that those aquifers aren't replenishing at the rate in which they could, tied to the changes in precipitation that we're seeing, but also tied to other large-scale climate in terms of drought. The food security is also of interest. Because where we think about where we grow our food, it's probably not where we think it is. National Geographic, I'll use that as another hook, perhaps. I call it the yellow rectangle. They have a good series of maps in which they compare pasture land and crop land. And the crop land exists in the breadbasket of America, right? But when you go a little bit further and you dig deeper into that data, you see that what we're growing in the breadbasket of America is actually fuel and feed. Fuel for our cars in terms of biofuels and feed for our cattle in terms of growing more cattle. And so our breadbasket of America is used for feed and fuel, not for food. And most of our food comes from Florida, the citrus, and we can talk about the greening of that whole issue. NPR listeners might know some of that greening issues in Florida. It comes from parts of California, and it comes from much of Southeast Asia, and much of Africa is growing a lot of food around the world. And so you think about where we grow our food and where people live. These are volatile circumstances, right? So if you have a monsoon and it washes away food, well, that's a problem. If you have prolonged drought, that also compromises the nutritional value of that food. And so again, these issues, I love weather and climate because it impacts every aspect of our life: economics, food production, national security, health, And the like. Back to the wildfires, perhaps, right? So the wildfires are burning, and that impact is catastrophic in every account. But the air is moving and taking that those clouds and debris, and you wouldn't want to breathe that air. And so people that are east of these wildfires are now encountering respiratory being compromised because of the aeroallergens that exist in the atmosphere tied to the wildfire. So again, making these connections, I think, is important not only from a communication standpoint, but also drawing attention to these issues, that they're complex. But we know that they're complex, we know the causes, and we can do things to address them.
Another issue that kind of gets skipped over in terms of climate change, and it goes back to food production that you mentioned, and is population displacement and the fact that if people find it untenable, as we've been experiencing, as people find it untenable to live for political reasons or for nutritional reasons, they move. Have you looked at all, or is there any sense of population displacement relative to climate change?
Yeah, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has a really nice graphic on their website. If you're interested, you're easily can find it. But it highlights the multitude of aspects of climate change. Enforced migration and migration of people is one of those boxes. And we saw this with Katrina. Again, Katrina was not caused by climate change, but Katrina-like events increase in probability with a changing climate. We saw people moving from New Orleans and parts of the Gulf Coast to every state in our union. There's researchers from California, and the scholar doesn't come to – I can't remember the scholar's name at this point in time. It's not important, but – I mean, it is important, but it's not important for this discussion. But he highlights that much of the ongoing refugee crisis in Syria can be attributed in some capacity – not causation again – but to some capacity to the ongoing drought in that region of the world. And so these ecological environmental consequences have serious impacts, right? The geopolitics of Syria, Turkey, India, and the like, that could have a serious repercussion with respect to migration of people. And I'll challenge the idea of what are wars fought over? And this might get into the weeds here perhaps, but wars are often fought over resources. Food, water, things that you need to live. If you don't have water, you're going to find water, right? Jamestown, not too far from here, there's evidence of the people at Jamestown, the first colonialists that came to Southeast Virginia, were cannibals. They ate each other because they needed food following some of those environmental characteristics they weren't accustomed to coming from a very different climate than here in Southeast Virginia and the Chesapeake Bay. And so when we have situations that require us to move or require us to find life-sustaining resources, all hands on deck. And so I think that's another reason that the Department of Defense is interested in climate change, despite some ideas that maybe it's not as important or as big as you think. The DOD is very interested in these issues.
Well, it's clear that in a number of ways climate change does create conflict, and it can be through conflict of securing resources or conflict of a war, as you mentioned. Let me shift just for a moment.
Okay.
In an article in New York Magazine by David Wallace Wells, and he does seem, it's a wonderful article, frankly, but it does seem to me to be one of the doomsday scientists. And you've already told us that you're not. And so I'm going to ask a question relative to David Wallace Wells. He argues in his paper that there is a scientific reticence to, and I think he's pointing his finger at you, Michael, but you can tell me if this is not the case. There's a scientific reticence to talk about the issue of climate change and global warming in as serious in as serious an issue as it is in his mind. Is there a scientific reticence or a reticence among the scientists to talk about how devastating this issue particularly is?
As a climate scientist, it is important for me to communicate to everyone and anyone that listens that there are serious implications with regard to climate change. With that said, though, I also have a responsibility to draw attention to the urgency and also draw attention to the opportunities that we have to address these issues. In my classes, some people leave and they feel it's a doomsday scenario. I talk about earthquakes and flooding and sea level rise and hurricanes and the like. And that's all well and good. We have to be clear as to what dangers exist in terms of. But in terms of a communication standpoint, some people regress. And I don't want my students, the people that, you know, the 18 to 25-year-olds, the millennials. I'm a millennial. I don't relate to somebody that is 18 in many regards, but I'm still a millennial. And I tell the students, my job is to stand in front of you and communicate these issues. And I might do that until the day I die. But your job is to go out in the world and solve the problems, to be the educators, the policymakers, the moms, the dads, the brothers and sisters, and to really not be hopeless, but to be hopeful in terms of how we address these challenges. And they are challenges, and they are real, and there is potential that they could be catastrophic. I think the other difficulty with respect to climate change is recognizing that the impacts are going to be different, right? And one of the challenges from a communication standpoint of climate is we talk about global issues. And people really don't care about what happens in India. They don't really care what happens in Norfolk, for many of your listeners, perhaps, right? We care about what's happening in our backyard. And there's some utility to that, right? So North Carolina has a really nice initiative in which they have highlighted its climate stories of North Carolina. And they go interview real people, farmers that are noticing, hey, crops are growing at different times of year. Or fishermen. One of my favorite is a fisherman from North Carolina. I can't remember where he's from exactly, but he highlights that he's fished and he fly fishes and he's out there all the time, and he realizes that his trout, he's not catching nearly as many trout as he used to, tied to the warming of the lakes and the different spawning season and the like. And I don't understand exactly what he's saying because I'm not a fisherman. I used to do it as a kid. I caught a 23-inch catfish once and I said, I'm done fishing because I set the benchmark so high. But he sees it real time, right? I'm happy to talk about the big picture, but really how we get change is those little stories and creating a narrative that is not cloudy to tell those personal stories of how climate change is impacting people on the ground in their everyday life.
Well, we talked a bit about reticence. And I know scientists tend to be very careful with their language and very careful with their data, and they want to be very accurate, and that's excellent. That's wonderful. Let me shift the word though from reticence to denial. Are we in a place basically of climate denial today? Because I see, frankly, a number of places where it occurs to me that someone is not paying attention here.
I'll challenge the vague we. Who is we? Are we in denial? Scientists are not very effective communicators. We're trained to talk about Stefan Boltzmann and draw a thermodynamic equation on the board and eyes glaze over you can hear the tweets on Twitter about, you know, my professor made me do this math or whatever, right? We're not good at communicators. And so from a layman standpoint, there's a disconnect. But make no mistake, the we is in scientists. There is no denying and no uncertainty with respect to the causal mechanisms of the observed climate change that we're seeing right now. And so from a scientific perspective, and I'm not sure I like this statistic necessarily, but it really gets at, right? So if you have a deadly disease, we'll say cancer, all of us probably have been impacted, I have personally in many ways, by that horrible disease. You go to a doctor and they say to you, you have cancer. You might go to another doctor to get a second opinion. And that doctor might say, you have cancer. And you might go to a third doctor. And if that doctor says, you have cancer, you're probably going to do something. You're not going to go to 100 doctors, right? And so from a communication standpoint, the narrative is really, well, there's some uncertainty. But there's as much uncertainty about the causes of climate change as there is about that the Earth is round. There is a 3% of scientists say that climate change is not happening or it's not human caused or what have you. But again, if you go to 100 doctors and 100 cancer doctors tell you that you, or 97 cancer doctors tell you that you have cancer and 3% tell you that you don't, are you going to listen to those three or are you going to listen to the 97s? And so again, from a science standpoint, we use this word consensus, and we use the word consensus, but it gets turned around in the general public that there's this 50-50 split between scientists. A better analogy perhaps is the idea of tobacco, right? We saw this narrative before in that smoke the lucky ones. Smoking is healthy if you smoke the good ones, and this doctor told me so. But the science at that point in time, the 70s and the 80s, said, well, cancer can cause, or smoking can be caused by tobacco, and something needs to be done about it, and it took years and years of these discussions. So there's some parallels to that analogy with respect to climate change. And so are we in denial of global warming? I say we as scientists are not. We're pretty certain. And from a layman, general public, there may be some denial, and we can talk about the causes, but before we do that, there's denial, but it's changing. So Yale Climate Connections, they have a survey that they give out, and I'm trying to think of the numbers exactly, but basically it's showing that many Americans believe climate change is happening. Many Americans, which is great, the narrative has changed 10 years ago that climate change wasn't even happening. So now the narrative is climate change is happening, fine. And the shift is beginning to swing also that the general public is beginning to accept that the scientists, NASA, American Geophysical Union, American Meteorological Society, and like, have all come to the conclusion that humans are the main contributor. And the next move is, what do we do about it? And those are fruitful discussions. How do we act to address the causes as well as the implications of climate change? And I'm happy to have those discussions. As I say, a thermometer is not Republican, nor is it Democrat. A thermometer, a tidal gauge at Sewell's Point or at Tangier Island is neither, it's apolitical, right? And so from a scientific perspective, some people say, don't be political. And I say, I'm not political. I look at the data and it tells me what it is, and I can explain that data using a sound scientific method.
Michael, you've outlined the problem beautifully, and to some degree the solutions. But I think we could have another an hour on the solutions and what we need to do. I'm particularly concerned when I use the we. I guess I was using the the king's we, in the sense that what I've seen that have bothered me most particularly is the denial in the sense of leaving the Paris Accords, the appealing of the carbon emissions rule, a non-scientist considered for the head of NASA, which is just a huge contributor to information on climate change, and the proposed cuts to the NASA budget in their earth sciences program is particularly, frankly, disturbing. And I think that was, to some degree, my sense of the use of the term denial. Well, thank you very much, Michael, for an interesting and enlightening discussion. And I want to thank all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.